If we don't operate in a fact-based, rules-based order, what's going on?
Mondays with Mike.
Mondays with Mike. Mondays with Mike.
So this week, December 3rd, NBC News came up with a story concerning Secretary of Defense, Secretary of War, whatever it is, Pete Hegseth, and I wrote down in the notes, PDH, at it again, but mostly it was old stuff. It did concern the shooting the boat twice, although that was a general that made that call, it would appear. But what NBC focused on was that the information that he shared in the group chat in March concerning war plans was marked secret, so if a foreign adversary had intercepted, that would have been bad. And when he was a commanding officer of some type in Iraq, he may have warned his soldiers to ignore legal advice about the rules of engagement. I initially wrote down, ignore the rules of engagement, and then I thought, no, gotta be very precise in terms of copying what they said. I wrote down, will he ever learn? Is that... Because it just seems to me like now when you get into power, you kind of do what you want and you pick up the pieces later. It's unfortunate, but that appears to be the de facto situation shaping up for me, in my mind.
It's the character of the person in the position of power. So in past administrations, if I screw up like this happens to such a degree, you would expect that some, I don't know, professional, ethical, moral leaders would go, okay, culpa, messed up, I resign. Instead of having to go through the rigmarole of an investigation, getting impeached, maybe being put on trial. Because what's clear, at least in this situation, is there's very little ambiguity. The arguments they're presenting, reaching a point of absurdity that wouldn't even hold in most debate rounds, right? Like because the evidence they're presenting is so flimsy and so weak as to why it was a justified strike for the second time in particular, that for the question of will he ever learn, what's the lesson here, right? Hegseth caught Trump's eye in part because he advocated for a reprieve for soldiers who were accused of just heinous stuff. Right, that's how he got on Trump's radar in the first place. If you look at the timeline, the saga of Hegseth, of why Trump likes him, is that Hegseth, he was a host of Fox. Anyways, that's a whole different story from the past. But the lessons are so bizarre here. If that they're trying to radiate strength or this sort of movie version of the use of military, right? There's bad guys, the bad guys get killed, and oh, there's heroes and everyone wins the day. But reality isn't this sort of Hollywood version of events. Reality is that the U.S. operates in a world of not just the U.S. being the only power. Let's put it that way. That all these rules are in place because the previous situation sucked, really sucked, that there weren't effective rules governing warfare. And so soldiers who were trying to surrender would be killed. People would be tortured, they'd be executed. And so all these conventions, the Vienna Treaty, Geneva Conventions, all that stuff came about because the U.S. and these other major powers wanted it such that if they lost an engagement, like a battle, that they wouldn't lose all of their fighting force, because it's a big thing for morale. It's tough to convince soldiers to fight if they know that they're going to be summarily executed anytime they lose. If they get caught away from supply lines, if they have to eject from a plane if there's some kind of malfunction, if they're on a ship, right, and they get hit by a torpedo and then they're floating in the water getting eaten by sharks, the expectation is not, okay, so a ship's going to come along and machine gun all the people. So I'm talking about the USS Indianapolis, where the ship that carried in secret atomic bombs, but before they got dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they had to bring it close enough. If you ever watch the movie or read the story about that, they had to travel without an armada, right? Without any defenses, just alone, because the whole entire mission was completely secret. And once they delivered the package, they also had to leave without the usual defenses you would have to protect against a torpedo attack or whatever. And lo and behold, when a ship that's big and doesn't have sufficient defenses is traveling in the middle of the ocean during a huge war, they get hit by a torpedo, it sinks, and hundreds of people are stuck in the Pacific getting eaten by sharks, right? As they're floating, waiting for rescue. If in that situation, the submarine that shot the torpedo then decided, we're just going to finish the job and shoot everybody floating, getting eaten by sharks, war crime. The other example is the one where the commander did in fact get executed by firing squad, along with a couple of other sailors involved in that submarine, where they sank a ship off of South America, where they got the ship was broken apart, and the submarine then surfaces and machine guns these sailors floating in the water. And it's, no, that's not okay. And so the submarine commander and a bunch of the higher ups, they're all executed after World War II. What's incredibly frustrating about this whole situation is that the U.S. is the one that led the charge for establishing the Nuremberg principles, for establishing that I was just following orders is not a valid defense in the face of atrocity, that soldiers right down to the very lowest rung have an affirmative obligation to not follow illegal or outright immoral orders, period, that they too can be prosecuted for war crimes all of the way up the chain. And so that's why it's a little bit mind-boggling that we will return to a time of horrific situations if countries that are fighting and soldiers that are fighting think that their only opportunity for survival is to fight to the death, pretty much, that they can't surrender because surrender is not an option. You either fight or you die, because that's the alternative. If there's no agreed upon system of principles or laws that you follow, even in wartime. But yeah, I hope he learns actually, the answer is yes, yeah. He did learn, right? Because we already have a real-time example of what happened. So September 2nd, the survivors get killed in a double tap. And then in a strike afterwards, survivors don't get killed. They get repatriated back to their country. So we already know that somewhere between then and then, right, between the first strike and the other strike, some kind of discussion occurred where they went, wait a second, we should not kill survivors in double taps. And they actually gave them medical, they rescued them, and they gave them medical treatment, and they sent them back to their countries. Like, those people are alive. So we already know, like, something happened, and I'm sure the investigation at some point will show this, that there was some kind of discussion that had to have happened. Each of these strikes are unique in their own separate way for the conditions, whatever it is that's going on. But we already know that in our only case example of these boat strikes, that there already were two different examples. One, survivors killed. Two, survivors not killed. One of those was the correct approach. The other wasn't.
So I think back to the end of World War II, where the victorious powers, you know, us, the Soviets, to some degree the British, the United Nations at large as well, and France, and China, although they were still in the Civil War, but the main two, us and the Soviets.
And the UK. And, I mean, the UK fought hard.
There was the UK, of course, but then the UK, you know, soon they bankrupt. I don't know exactly about bankrupt, but they couldn't afford to keep what they had. And so the system, the United Nations system that emerged as a result of that, was built on the presumed equality of each nation, of each state, in terms of having an equal voice and a rules-based world order. So Soviets aren't there anymore, but Russia still is, and now China's up, but we're still the superpower, and we will be for some part of the 21st century, and we don't know when history turns over. And I'm thinking we need to set an example while we're in the seat of caring about a rules-based order, because it's, I'm not going to say the greatest, but a pretty great contributor toward the stability of future society and toward the welfare of our posterity, therefore. And so it's good if we move toward observing rules, that's good. And thinking you should just double tap a boat, this isn't a video game, this isn't the movies. If this was the movies, we'd spend a lot less time doing laundry. It's the world is mundane, but in a good way. Like, you You need to do what you want.
The system we have isn't perfect by any measure, clearly, because it hasn't achieved certain objectives, mainly stopping aggression. Given that Russia, a permanent security council member, invaded Ukraine and is currently trying and in some way succeeding to secure territory and land in the negotiations for the peace, that it looks certainly like Russia is going to keep at least something, that part of it didn't really succeed. But other aspects of the UN have succeeded, that we have reduced the amount of wars, and also that there are examples of peacekeeping operations that have succeeded for sure, at least for the duration that they're going between North and South Korea, Cyprus. There's a handful that are in fact holding and continue to hold. And so to that extent, the UN does serve a function. For any of these discussions, I always think of it, you look at the situation in light of the alternatives. And the alternatives would be a sort of Hobbesian state of anarchy, right? A state of war, right, which is all versus all, constant fighting, that you only get what you can get because you're strong enough to get it. And that it's just constant death and destruction and just horror. What's clear is that there is some impediment to that kind of fighting and that kind of destruction, that there's at least a little bit more subtlety in the way that countries fight, that the ways that they engage in combat are not so direct or conventional anymore, bombing and shooting and just mass devastation. And so I think that's important when you talk about a rules-based order, that the UN in particular is very effective at reducing the spread of chemical weapons, biological weapons, and then nuclear weapons, that there is a system in place, and it keeps those weapons from actually being used. When you see conflict, right now, the conflict is narrow. The range of tools that could be used aren't being used. And that is better news than the alternative. That at least is something. Mm-hmm. When you see this situation going on right now of one of the major powers engaging in these boat strikes, that whittles away at the foundation, right, of this order, you would call it, this rules-based order. It doesn't look good if the government can't get a handle on making sure that this stuff doesn't happen. I guess the absurdity of this situation for me, with all the years of being a debater and judging debate, is that you have senators and members of Congress make a video that say what is written in pretty much in the DoD manual. You have the right and actually the obligation to refuse illegal orders, period. If you're given an order and it's illegal, don't do it, because you as a soldier could be held accountable. I'm not by the, but the a proverbial you, the example of somebody in that situation. And the administration's response when they make that video is, oh, it's sedition. Oh, put them on trial. And then when you have the real life example of exactly what they're talking about, something that sure appears from the outside to be either an illegal order or really close to that line, the response isn't, oh, let's court-martial, put them on trial, and get to the bottom of it. It's trying to wrangle. So far, I've heard at least six different stories of what happened, when it happened, how it happened, and variations of events, trying to finesse it in the most like abstruse ways. So one of them was Senator Cotton, where he's saying that they were like signaling for help, or they're in a radio or whatever. And then if you listen to the Congressman Hines, who saw the video, he's saying that these guys were in the water for hours. It wasn't some like immediate thing, that we're talking hours and hours just floating on this broken apart boat. And that doesn't seem like they're immediately trying to get back in the fight and keep fighting, or even can.
Yeah.
But I'm also thinking about the fact that it wasn't, if you look at the timeline of events, the secondary strike wasn't immediate. It wasn't boom, 9 dead, 2 survivors, boats on flames and destroyed, and then boom, another missile. No, apparently there was a discussion for 41 minutes. That's a long time. 41 minutes is a really long conversation. And the question I have, is that the value of a human life now, right? 41 minutes? Yeah. Is that where we're at as a society? The standard for surviving after, it's hard to believe that these individuals weren't incapacitated or injured, at least after their ship blew up and it's on fire and they're getting smoke inhalation floating in the water. Like, it's super hard to believe that they had a fighting ability in any way, shape, or form.
If they're adrift at sea, they're not a threat, at least not immediately.
Exactly, which makes them not really a viable target. Then you juxtapose that with Trump pardoning the leader of Honduras, who was convicted of essentially moving tons of cocaine into the U.S. So the whole pretext they're making is that this is a war against drugs, all that stuff. There weren't tons of drugs on that boat, right? It's not a big boat. And it's just when you juxtapose that they're targeting like the very lowest or second lowest rung in the org chart with death, and then releasing the very tippy top of the org chart, the kingpin dude, right, with freedom after what I can only assume was a huge investigation. How do you prove that? Oh. They had to have done, marshaled a lot of resources, spent a lot of time, a lot of manpower. And it's the height of ridiculousness that Trump goes, oh, it was a Biden hoax or whatever that nonsense is. Who cares who the president is, right? The Justice Department is separate from the president. Like they're charged with seeing if there's a crime, investigating the crime, presenting the evidence so that you can prosecute them at trial. Pretty straightforward.
You know what it makes me think of? It makes me just imagine, what if they started saying, that unleaded gasoline, that's a hoax. Lead in the air, that's just a Democrat hoax.
Yeah,
nothing to worry about.
Lead in the water, like what?
Yeah, it's just a hoax.
If we don't operate in a fact-based, rules-based order, what's going on? Because and I think what's a sort of a slap in the face for all of this is this weird cognitive dissonance, okay? Where they're asked, don't you see a problem with pardoning the criminal drug lord, former president of Honduras? Because of what? Because the people of Honduras asked you? I don't, because I listened to Trump's reason and it was, I didn't understand the justification. It's like the people of Honduras asked him to release. So I understand what's going on, that there's an election for a new president in Honduras between three candidates, and that this was like a, I don't know, not a gift, but like a way to sway the election towards the more conservative candidates in Honduras. Something like that. I don't know how, I don't know why it's perceived that way, but that's for why that might happen. But even then, like, it doesn't make any sense from the perspective of, we're trying to stop the flow of drugs and engage in this drug war, because what kind of deterrence is that? That if you're rich enough and you're powerful enough that you're going to get pardoned? Just be like, it's the same stuff with the crypto thing. It's like, why are these crypto people who were found guilty of money laundering, of helping these criminal organizations and enterprise succeed at their criminality? Frankly, that's how they get money, right? Because their money is, it goes from dirty money to clean money, so they can actually use the money. Why are they getting pardoned? What's the deal? The height of, like, how can we believe our ears of what we're hearing of Trump going, I don't even know the guy and I'm pardoning him? What is that?
I don't know.
What is,
it's something else.
What is going on there? Does he not understand that when you pardon? No, he understands. When you pardon someone, they're free to go. When a pardon goes forward, all restitution goes away. They don't have to pay if they had to pay money to somebody for harming them or causing damage to someone and they were supposed to pay restitution to the victims. When a pardon goes forward, restitution goes away. And so I was reading about that there's just a huge amount of money that was supposed to go to victims of these crimes. You're just not going to get anymore. It's like, what is the deal?
What kind of incentive structure does this all set up in these enterprises? In whether it is these drug cartels or crypto? It's like, if you're a foot soldier, we'll shoot you. And then we'll shoot you twice to make sure you're dead. But then, if you make it to the top, if you're the kingpin, you get to walk free. What kind of... I'm thinking of the multiple of how much in a corporation does the lowest paying person get paid, and then compare that to the multiple of what does the CEO or the highest paying person get paid. And I... far be it for me to advocate for a more humane system for drug traffickers or alleged drug traffickers, but where's the human decency? You're at the bottom, you get double tapped like it's some stupid video game. You're at the top, you get to walk around. This is nonsense. This is a kooky new world. I don't even know what to call this.
No, that's actually a pretty good parallel. So CEOs get golden parachutes. Even if they crash a company, they still get to fly away with millions of dollars. The workers at the bottom or the people who lose their pensions, they don't. They're out of luck. They don't get millions of dollars sent their way. They're lucky if they get anything at all. And so that's a pretty similar parallel that at a certain level of wealth, the wealthiest walk in circles where they have, when we talk about a two-tier system of justice, this is that kind of thing where if you're wealthy enough, you sprinkle some money around or you ask your friends to advocate on your behalf or to help you out. And lo and behold, sometimes it works. For those at the bottom, they don't get it. They have to hope and pray that they get hurt at all. There, so far, there, my understanding is there's only one complaint that's been filed in the international human rights thing that the US is part of for the Western Hemisphere, where they're saying, look, he was a fisherman. He wasn't what you're saying he was. We want compensation and prove it. Like, there's only one complaint so far. Who knows if they're going to get hurt? We'll see, but it's different. Anyways, in terms of, I know that was a bit of a segue, not a segue, but it's wandered away
Like
from
a
the.
country road. It was a bit of a country road.
Sure.
Sunday drive.
It wandered away from the original discussion. Heath's headset. Look, I think the soonest that there would be any kind of real accountability is going to be if the Democrats win in the midterms, where if they get a majority in the House or the Senate such that they can override a veto, then they can start impeaching because cabinet officials can be impeached. So they can start impeaching all these people all along the line of the ones who are disobeying orders from judges, the ones who are engaging in tactics and practices that certainly seem to be at the line or across the line of what, you know, is legal or ethical. That's all going to get resolved in court, and impeachment's one of the venues that they can do that. We'll see. But yeah, that's why the midterms are super important, is that I am skeptical that the Republicans are going to do anything significant in terms of accountability. Maybe they'll say this sucks and this is bad and let's do better. But I am very skeptical that they'll do anything with real teeth, like an impeachment or even a criminal referral. For the Democrats, I'm not skeptical. I think they would. I think that given the opportunity, and if they secure power again within the legislature, that there's not going to be any real hesitation. I don't think so, because it's a political winner, frankly, to make sure that the U.S. is following its own laws, because it's terrible for morale for soldiers if they don't think that in conflict they would be allowed to surrender. You don't always win every military engagement, right? Especially the foot soldiers. Sometimes there's just not enough of whatever you need. Ammunition, resources, supply lines get cut. You can get stuck behind enemy lines. Planes malfunction, right? Sometimes a pilot does have to just parachute out of a plane because the engine stops working. The point is that sometimes things happen and it sets a terrible precedent for an all-volunteer force if the only options are fight to the death or get summarily executed when you try to surrender. Like, it just sets a terrible precedent. And there's a reason why these rules exist. It's not just right to protect human life or morality. Like, there are very real stakes within being able to even have a professional functioning military because of the fact that they have to recruit and not everybody's just drafted into the military. People have a choice of whether they do this work. It's going to be really terrible for recruitment if they don't resolve this in such a way that it shows that the United States does in fact value, that they value protecting their soldiers in combat. The integrity of these rules within the U.S. Code of Military Justice and international human rights laws and the law of armed conflict, that they're real, that the laws are real, and that they're followed. It's super important.
Mondays with Mike.